got a pretty great panel this afternoon. The title of the panel is The Road Less Traveled, Exceptional Career Paths. And I think you guys are really going to like this one. If you ever dream of being an astronaut, an NFL linebacker, a slam poet, or a polar explorer growing up, then you're in luck. We have all four. Please put your phones away and pay full attention to our speakers. And if you're interested in helping organize the conference on World Affairs in Boulder, Ohio next year, please contact Becky in the library and Ms. Gossett. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce this panel's moderator, Ms. Dana Cookson.
Thank you so much for coming to this, our last panel for Boulder High's Conference on World Affairs. We do ask not only that you put away your cell phones, but that you turn them off if you still have access to them. That way we don't have any screens or sounds during our panel introductions or during the time for questions. We'll keep an eye on the clock to let you guys know when we're getting them. Okay, so I'm going to start by giving a brief introduction on each of our panelists and then give them each about 10 to 15 minutes to introduce themselves, giving you time to learn a bit about them and then decide what questions you might have for them. So we're going to start with Chris Borland. He is a former All-American linebacker from the University of Wisconsin. He was drafted by the San Francisco 49ers in 2014 and led the team in tackles as a rookie. Borland was named to the NFL All-Rookie Team and the NFL Pro Team as an alternate for his efforts. Since retiring from professional football over concerns of repetitive brain trauma, he has been an advocate for concussion awareness, mental health, and for aid for former football players in dire need. Borland was awarded the Concussion Legacy Foundation's Impact Award in 2015. He has worked with the Carter Center Mental Health Program and the Gridiron Grace Assistance Fund. And a newly released documentary, Requiem for a Running Back. Borland is currently the co-lead on a study exploring the benefits of mindfulness and meditative practices to promote wellness for former athletes. He lives in Madison, Wisconsin. Please welcome Chris Borland. We also have joining us Sam Cook. He's the founder and executive director of Button Poetry, the premier online distributor of performance poetry media worldwide. Cook is a TEDx fellow and a national poetry slam champion and an acclaimed public speaker. He has performed at dozens of colleges and other venues around the US as well as Canada and Costa Rica. He is recipient of the Verve Grant from Intermedia Arts and the first grant for spoken word poets nationwide. As a mentor and coach, Cook has led numerous college poetry teams to national finals stages and to accolades, including the Best Individual Poet Award for 5 years in a row. He is committed to using his work as an educator, organizer, artist, and executive to broadcast necessary stories and diverse voices. He is also a Boulder High alum. We also have John Houston, a professional polar explorer and a veteran of the first American unsupported expedition to the North Pole. He has completed major expeditions to the South Pole, on Greenland, and to Canada's fabled Ellesmere Island. He is a motivational speaker, safety and logistics consultant, and wilderness guide. He regularly speaks to companies and organizations, referencing his expeditions to discuss overcoming challenges. He has appeared on CNN, the History Channel, National Public Radio, and in Outside Magazine and Popular Mechanics. Houston and his family live in Evanston, Illinois, where he works at Northwest University overseeing a student outdoors program. Please welcome John. And finally, we have Loretta Hidalgo Whitesides. Her and her now husband were among the first two people to buy a ticket for a suborbital space flight on Virgin Galactic's Spaceship Two. Trained as an astrobiologist at Stanford and Caltech, she has been to the Canadian Arctic to study plant life in extreme environments and to the hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean with Titanic director James Cameron to film a 3D IMAX documentary, Aliens of the Deep. She's the co-creator of Yuri's Night, the World Space Party, celebrated annually all around the planet on or around April 12th. She has over 5 hours of time spent floating weightless in a 727 aircraft as a flight director for the Zero-G Corp. Her passion is using space to inspire humanity with what is possible. She's training to be a better Jedi so she won't yell at her two small children anymore. Please welcome her. We'll now have each panelist do about a 10 to 15 minute introduction in the order that they were introduced, and I will keep an eye on the time for you as well.
Sounds great. Thank you, and thank you all for being here. The title of today's panel is called Exceptional Career Paths, and I think I'll just tell you a story to convey how I feel mine was an exceptional career path. I recently moved back to Madison, Wisconsin, and that's where I went to college and played football. And when I came back to town, I was thinking about who I was when I left. And I was preparing for the NFL draft. I was about 25 pounds heavier, a little more athletic, a little more narrowly focused in my career path. And when I returned just a few months ago, found myself sitting in a yurt outside of Madison, which is much like Boulder, with a woman who referred to herself as Wildflower. And I had an old teammate in town. And so after I got done at the yurt, I went and had a whiskey with my buddy, and he was asking what I was up to. And I told him where I came from, and I said, well, Jake, it's kind of a long story. What took me from this 245-pound, narrowly focused, aspirational linebacker to an alternative lifestyle and to getting into modalities that will help some of my former teammates and friends? Is in some ways a complicated story, but in others, fairly straightforward. I enjoyed a pretty good deal of success while in college. I was an All-American and Big Ten Defensive Player of the Year, and was drafted in the third round by the 49ers. And up until that point in my life, was obsessed with football. I mean, I lived and breathed it. We probably have some football players in here today who can relate. I grew up in Southwest Ohio, where it's like a religion. My dad was a college football player. And it meant so much to me. I was very much born and bred in that lifestyle and loved it and was able to thrive. Our high school team won our first ever state championship my senior year. Wisconsin's always my dream school. My family's from the area and we were Badger fans. So when it worked out, and I was offered a scholarship there, I committed within an hour. And I know we've got Mr. Ramsey. Y'all know Mr. Ramsey? Raise your hand if you knew that he was a stud football player at the University of Wisconsin. But things continued to go really well. We enjoyed a great deal of success during my time in college. We won 3 Big Ten championships as a team. Went to the Rose Bowl 3 times. We lost to Stanford.
That was a good game.
Yeah. But it was such a fun ride, and ultimately fulfilled my dream of becoming an NFL player. If you would have told a 5'6", 150-pound freshman at Alter High School that you'd be drafted to live a dream and play in the NFL, while I wanted to do it, I truly wouldn't have believed you. I mean, it seemed impossible for me when I was that young. And so I made it and was thrilled to be on that stage. Again, I feel like I was fortunate to live somewhat of a charmed life as a football player at the NFL level. When mid-season our star linebacker Patrick Willis got hurt, I was the next man in. And while I was rocky at first, my first start was here in Denver. Peyton Manning set the all-time touchdown record on us. We lost 42-17. And I was thinking, oh, the charmed life's over. I'm going to be a failure as an NFL linebacker. This is terrible. We rebounded and finished with a good season. Personally, I enjoyed some success. So the dream was realized, and then it became my normal. And while all this was going on, I was looking into some of the research that became available as far as it pertains to traumatic brain injury in football. This began at the onset of my NFL career. I had a concussion in camp that I played through, and it just got me thinking. It wasn't a bad concussion, but I think the timing that it happened really made me approach the game differently, because you don't run out of eligibility in college, in the NFL. You can play, and my goal was to play for as long as possible. So I began to wonder, what would these instances accumulated over time do to me? I really was naive. I had heard of the brain disease, CTE, but didn't know what it stood for. I thought players who taken their lives, or players who had highly publicized struggles down the road, were the outliers. And as I was having success as a linebacker, my rookie year with San Francisco, was also learning more and more about brain damage. And the more I gathered, more information I gathered, the more I was honest with myself about my experiences and the reality of my position as a player, ultimately I decided to walk away. Again, I was naive when I left the game. I thought maybe this would be a story on ESPN for a couple of days. And again, the timing was another issue. Patrick actually retired a week before I did. And I took solace in making the decision, knowing that the organization had their star linebacker coming back, Patrick Willis. I was actually teaching a clinic in Mexico with a friend, a Stanford guy who beat us in the Rose Bowl, James Gove, and got a text that Patrick had walked away. And my heart kind of sunk, because I knew I'd made the decision by that point, and it was going to be a blow to, if there's any 49ers fans here, I have to apologize occasionally. But I felt I had to do it. My goals in the game and my goals of personal health diverge, and you have to side with personal health in my evaluation. So I made that decision and naively was stepping into a world that was white hot. I understood some of the political nature of the research and the NFL and NCAA and elsewhere, but probably underestimated how intense it can get. And never made this decision with anything else in mind other than my own personal health and my goals in and out of the game, but found myself in a position as an advocate. And while I'm reluctant to do it, I mean, it's truly uncomfortable for me. I had a panel this morning where I was in tears because I've worked with some guys who've overdosed because they're addicted to painkillers, and I have personal friends who, you know, I can't call them anymore because they've passed. And while that's not the common outcome for former players, it is a reality. And so in talking about it and in advocating, while it's uncomfortable, I just feel I'm further uncomfortable in being silent. And that's really the only reason I found myself here today on this stage. That's part of the reason I found myself on a yurt in Madison with Wildflower. Jake still probably doesn't understand what I was doing there, but I can try to tell you. I've been exploring a lot of different modalities and therapies that can help former NFL players and former college players. And in so doing, I've come across everything from hyperbaric chambers to craniosacral therapy and on and on and on, and was getting pretty worn out because there aren't very many proven therapies for traumatic brain injury. And ironically, I started to struggle myself. I was really stressed out. I felt like I was up against the world, and began to meditate. And I can't tell you how much of a benefit I've had from meditation. And it clicked. We were talking before we came over here today about how I ended up in that yurt and working on this project that I'm currently working on. It clicked. Meditating helped me, and here I was working with players who didn't understand this may be something that could be a part of their self-care. And it's two worlds that are so much more alike than you'd imagine. Meditation and mindfulness is a skill that you can cultivate and get better at and improve at self-care. And football is just the same. You know, you work and set goals, and you have that next thing you want to achieve, and you work towards it. And you have setbacks, too, and the same is true sometimes in your practice. And I thought that these two realms should meet one another. And there's as it turns out, a world-famous neuroscientist at the University of Wisconsin, who's famous for proving that meditation changes your brain physiologically. His name's Richie Davidson, and he works at the Center for Healthy Minds. The third time I was naive was in not knowing that Richie was down the street. I was at Wisconsin for 5 years, and I just didn't know. I don't know how that happened, but here this guy was in my backyard. So we had a mutual friend, and I reached out and scheduled a meeting with him. And I just told him, you know, Dr. Davidson, I've explored all of these things, and I can't come to answers. And he was the first person I talked to that didn't try to sell me anything. He said, listen, if you have the damage, you'll have the damage. But what mindfulness meditation may be able to do is help temper the symptoms. And it was really refreshing to hear someone who in himself had taken a unique path. Dr. Davidson started out his career studying the negative parts of psychology, depression, anxiety, and the like. And after a chance encounter with the Dalai Lama posed a question, why don't you use the tools of modern neuroscience to study what makes us happy, study what makes us compassionate and interested. And for him, he told me a light clicked in that. And had he not taken that path, he wouldn't be a resource for me in taking my path. So I'm just thrilled with this project. We're putting former NFL players through an 8-week pilot study and then hopefully continue on afterwards. To me, it's a lesson in showing that when you venture out of your uncomfortable zone, you learn things, you get exposed to people, and you grow. And I never thought, last time I lived in Madison, that I would be back or that I would be here, but I'm really glad I am. Thank you.
I'll give you it up one more time. That was pretty fantastic. So how you guys doing today? Pretty good? Almost end of the school day, end of the week, yeah? Feeling pretty good? How many of you are excited to be here at this event, actually, for real? That's amazing. So I want you to know that I remember being in this room. I sat on the other side of this panel, 15 years ago, 16 years ago, and I was not super excited to be, in most of the assemblies. So thank you guys so much for being awesome and enthusiastic, and I hope that I can reciprocate and bring something good into the room for all of y'all. When I first read about this panel, I looked down the list and I'm like, okay, a professional athlete, an astronaut, a polar explorer, and a poet. Okay? That kind of sounds like they're about to walk into a room and I'm going to end up being the butt of a joke. It's one of the things about being an artist. So how many artists do we got in the room? We have artists? Awesome, artists. More of you are than you know, I promise. Many, many things in this life are art, and we all find reasons that it ends up being a part of our lives. I think the reason I am here today is that I knew, probably even younger than y'all, that really what I wanted to do in my life was to be an artist and make art. And there were some really incredible teachers and administrators that supported that dream. There's one in this room, in fact, named Holly Gossard, who I had English with and who like really helped me on that arc. There's another one, I don't know if she's in the room, but I think she still teaches here, named Miss Araculis. And I love the two of them deeply as instructors. But the thing I'm driving at is that the arts aren't always super supported and super encouraged. So when I was y'all's age, I was learning not to have the arts as my only dream. And I know that's a hard thing to say or whatever, but it is my experience. And maybe things are different now, but it was, all my teachers were like, hey, consider the sciences. You're really smart. Go be an engineer. Program computers. You're good at that. You can make art on the side or whatever. And that didn't work for me. So I'm going to tell you a little about my path through that stuff. I might read you something that I do and sort of show you what I do. And I'll also tell you a little bit more about what it means to be a poet in today's world or some other kinds of performing artists and publishing artists. Where to start? So there is this whole world of In poetry, there's a thing called the National Poetry Slam. I won this thing, and it was a big deal, and it changed the course of my life, but it's also, it's not something, who's heard of the National Poetry Slam? Anybody? Cool, awesome, that is way more than I thought. Let me ask, how many of you have heard of button poetry? And if you're, okay, cool, I did not expect the hands. Thank you guys, that's awesome. So the National Poetry Slam is a big festival event where 500 to 600 poets gather and read poetry and they compete. It's a sport, right? You like assign Olympic-style scores to poetry and you decide who wins. And it's this arbitrary, bizarre thing, right? You know, because numbers, how do you tell what poem is a 9 and which one's an 8 and you know, all that whole thing. Except that you realize that's what we do with all art. We assign $900 or $2,500 or $35,000 as a salary or whatever. So we make a joke out of it, we assign numbers, we pick winners. So I won this thing, my team won it 2 years in a row, and it afforded me the possibility to travel around the country reading poems to people who wanted to hear poems. And that was one of the most incredible blessings that's ever happened in my life. So utilizing that, I was able to move into a space where I launched this platform called Button Poetry. And Button is a tool to allow artists to speak directly to an audience. It's a platform that is designed to remove producers and executives and designers from the equation so that speakers actually can convey their message, not a watered-down version of their message. And a lot of these are really hard messages or important messages or things that are maybe not said in classrooms or said around the dinner table or said in polite conversation or whatever. Because that's how we live. And I think that's really an important part of what is next for all of us, is finding a way to engage the hard parts of our lives and make those part of the good part of our lives. Like stop bifurcating and dividing who we are and having the part that we don't live and the part that we show to the rest of the world. So sorry. You guys stress me out a little bit, because I remember being on the other side of this thing. And I really would like to say something useful to you, and I'm probably going to end up rambling as a result. So let me read you something. Is that okay? Can I share something that I do with you guys? Is that cool?
Just hold it in your hand.
That's not what I do.
Oh, sorry. Forgot. You gotta slam.
You gotta slam, right? Yeah.
So, riding the Hudson Line north, the train sounded like it was sobbing as we slid out of Grand Central Station. This story is about a character who is not me. It's important that you remember I am not him. When I was old enough, I joined the army. I learned exactly how little one man can do with two hands. I served 4 tours. They sent me home on account of a growing fear of crowds, honorably discharged, the service, the job I did, that I just don't talk about. So I moved to New York City. I mean, I love to ride trains and subways, and what better place to face my fears? Riding the Hudson Line north, the train sounded like it was humming to itself. The rustle and hum of newspapers was the loudest noise. You could tell who was sleeping by their breath. And then a child began to cry, quietly at first, and then louder, until that rustle and hum began to replace with midweek tantrum, with sobs involuntary, the child's voice climbing like fire up pine trees, climbing in pitch until the passenger was shouting back, his mother shouting, "He is sick. I am sorry. He is sick." And they were still shouting. Women were standing up in their seats. I could feel the rocks cracking against the walls. It was not
any kind of nightmare. There was a man in Carhartt coveralls standing up in the aisles, his face thrust into their seats. This woman was riding alone with two children from two seats back. I could smell this man. From behind, I could have mistaken him for my grandfather. And then the man grabbed the eldest child by a skinny brown wrist, and everything stopped. I think people kept on shouting, "I don't remember you." This train's passengers were white, and it did not take her hijab to mark her as different. I took two steps towards her Carhartt on her assailant. I panicked for a moment. I made eyes at the horizon. I pretended I was still a soldier. Stepped within a breath and touched the man's arm. I saluted and said, "Sir, I can take it from here." I returned the child's bruised wrist to his mother like it was a parcel, or he were a prisoner released, and it was over. Except that I ask you to remember that this man is not me, because this is a true story, only that I did nothing. I sat across from this woman and did nothing. I made eye contact and wished I had not. The man shook the child and shouted until everything was silent but him, and I did not speak up. Each of us only gets so many opportunities to show another person that humanity is more than just the people behind you who will trample you when you fall, and I did not speak up. This is a secret I kept so long that I know it like a chipped tooth. I have rubbed myself raw on the edges of my own cowardice as long as I can remember, and this is how I remember how hard it can be to speak up.
Another round of applause.
10. That was
so I planned to read something funny about being kind of high school-y, college-y age that's fun and has jokes and whatever. And I realized that the thing that I want to talk about up here entirely is just that, like, I do not believe that success ends at the end of a narrow road. I believe that success is the result of failure. I believe that success is the result of trying and trying and doing it wrong and trying and doing it wrong. And that's what that poem is about doing the wrong thing and never fucking... Ooh. You know, I even edited the poem to move the curse words from the... Anyway, so... High schools. So I really believe that success, all success, is the result of knowing what you want, or even not knowing what you want, but being willing to try anyway, and to keep on trying through failure. And for me, that poem transformed many times before it became that piece. It took a long time for me to realize that poem was trying to tell me that I needed to speak a truth that I was concealing and lying to myself about. The first drafts of that tell the story and don't talk about that narrative, the narrative of this woman who is assaulted by this stranger, you know? And it shouted at me, it demanded to be let into my life, right? And so that's how I feel about the arts in general. The place I'm going to land on is to talk, like, just talking about this sort of like failure and success thing. I told you I won this National Poetry Slam championship tournament thing, and that allowed me to do all this other stuff. But I didn't go there straight from high school or straight from college or anything like that. I went there partway through a degree in linguistics that I got at the University of Minnesota that I started because I had been a contractor working on houses when the housing market collapsed in the mid 2000s, 2006, 2007, depending where you were. And before that, I had helped run a mobile home park. And before that, I'd been a pizza delivery driver and a flower delivery driver and a number of other delivery drivers and a projectionist. And throughout all of these things, I was in school studying to be an engineer or in school studying economics. And I've used all of these incredible things I learned, but I guess my point, the place I want to land, is that in my own life, at least, my lived experience is that if there's something you need to do, don't worry, it'll tell you, you know? Like, you might do the wrong thing first, you might do the wrong thing second, but it's gonna keep on talking to you. It's gonna make noise, you know? So that's what I got for you as an opener. Cheers.
Do you want me to go next?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Wow. So, my name is Loretta Whitesides, and ever since I was a little girl, I've known that I wanted to go into space. It's always been my dream. In fact, I didn't want to live in space. I was like, I thought that would just be normal by the time I grew up. Unfortunately, like, the technical reality hasn't quite caught up. But it's been fun. I never wanted to be a NASA astronaut because I thought by the time I grew up, you know, everyone would just have a rocket in their own garage. You wouldn't need to be a NASA astronaut to go. So I'm still working on that reality for you guys. Don't worry, you guys not hearing. One of the things I've learned over my career is that the future doesn't just happen. You can't just wait on the couch for the future to arrive. Like, we actually have to make it. It's up to us. We're the ones who build it. Progress isn't a given. So anyway, I went to high school. I piled up my resume with everything I could, and track and cross country and drama and student government and everything else to try to get into Stanford. Got the big letter, and I was really happy. But then the first thing I had to deal with right there was the imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And so if nobody's told you about this yet, you should know about this now. Which is very common that you just like, everyone has some sort of self-doubt. Even the cocky people, even the bullies, even the psychopaths. Usually they're psychopaths because they have self-doubt. There's something like, well, I don't belong here. I shouldn't be here. I don't deserve this. But you actually do. Anyway, when I was, and then you reach that terrifying moment when you're a senior in college, and you have to deal with like everyone's asking you, okay, you know, what are you gonna do after you graduate? And you're like, I don't know. Stop asking me that. And luckily, I remember sitting in the dorms and my senior year, and I was talking to a wizened graduate student, and I was terrified of what I was going to do next. And he said, Loretta, you're about to graduate from Stanford University. You can do anything you want. Now, you don't have to go to Stanford to give yourself permission to do anything you want, by the way. You know, whatever chair you're sitting in, you can do that same exercise. And he said, what do you most want to do? Like blank sheet, like blue sky, name it, anything in the world, what do you want to do? And I thought about it, and I said, I want to go work at the astronaut office in Houston, Texas. And he said, great, call him in the morning. And so I did. I called up NASA, and this is the mid-90s, and they sort of laughed. And they said, yeah, we're in a hiring freeze. And I said, I know you're in a hiring freeze. I want to come work for free. And that just threw her. She didn't know how to answer that. She said, what? And so they passed me off to the intern office, and Mike Kincaid listened to me. He figured out that I wasn't a crazy person off the street, and he decided to take a chance on me. And after graduation, I got to go down and work in the astronaut office, which was, for me, it was like the coolest job in the world. Like, get to go to the Monday morning staff meeting with 100 astronauts is pretty cool. And I was just, you know, the intern. But it set off this incredible. So anyway, I worked at NASA for 2 years. I worked on the International Space Station, helping to get that ready. And then I moved back to California. I'm from California originally, and living in Texas is essentially living abroad for Californians. So I eventually had to sort of scurry back home. And I worked at NASA Ames Research Center in California for a while, and met one of my mentors, Chris McKay. And I actually just emailed him yesterday on my birthday to thank him for everything he's given in my life. Oh, thanks, yeah. 43. And while I was there, I thought, well, maybe I should go, maybe I should be more like Chris. Maybe I should go get my PhD, and then I could, you know, become a research scientist or become an astronaut or walk on the moon or whatever. Oh, by the way, there's never been a woman who's walked on the moon. We've sent 12 people, the Earth, humanity, has sent 12 people to the moon. All of them were American, all of them were white, all of them were male, and all of them walked on the surface of the moon before I was born. And like I just said, I just turned 43, so we haven't been to the moon in a while. So there hasn't been a woman in the moon, so I was always like, oh, maybe in the back of your mind, my little ego, I'm pretty, you know, I like being impressive. That was one of my things, is like my that big resume. And I was like, oh, I could be the first woman on the moon. Oh, that would be so cool. And so I decided to go to Caltech for my PhD, because a PhD, that what's more impressive than that, right? Some people are going to be super impressed by me then. So I got my acceptance into Caltech, and the same thing happened. I was like, oh, I must have been, the admissions department must have made a mistake on me, right? And I show up at graduate school, and it was great, because there was 26 of us in my incoming class at Caltech in the biology department. And we were like hanging around one night, like, you know, getting to know each other, and we realized that every single one of us, to a T, thought we were the admissions department mistake. And we knew that wasn't possible, statistically. We're scientists, you know. And so that was when my whole imposter syndrome started to crumble a little bit. I was like, well, I started to be a little skeptical of myself. Like, well, maybe I do belong. Maybe I am this smart enough. Maybe I am good enough. And so one of the things I recommend when we're dealing with imposter syndrome is like, is just to talk about it too. Like if everyone's, you know, if it's the things that you hide, like Sam was just talking about, it's the things that you hide that get you into trouble. Is when you, so for me, I've redefined success as like being fully who I am, being unabashedly who I am, with no secrets and nothing hidden. So if I'm feeling insecure or nervous, I'm like, yeah, I'm feeling insecure and nervous. Anyone else feeling insecure and nervous? You know. And it's pretty disarming because other people are like, yeah, I am too. Yeah, okay, cool. Well, all right, so what else are we going to do today? You know, like, and then you move on, and it's not a boogeyman anymore. So the other secrets that I had in graduate school is I realized at some point during my PhD that sort of similarly, like, this isn't me. This isn't for me. And so I had this, I call it coming out of the closet process, where I dropped out of graduate school, and I was like, look, I'm not cut out to be a research scientist, and you're not cut out to be an engineer. Like, you know, who you are, you could tell, like, when he was up there, right? Like, he was put on Earth to be a slam poet. And you know that feeling you got when he was doing what he came here to do? You were like, it was magical. You're like, thank God Sam figured it out, you know? This is so good. And so for me, like that was for me, that's what success is getting more and more who I am out in the world. And so I started, you know, this always happened. So I dropped out of school, which was actually really good timing again, because about that time James Cameron came looking for astrobiologists to take to the bottom of the ocean, and I was like, I'm an astrobiologist. And he's needed people who could take a month off to spend a month out at sea in the Atlantic and a month out at sea in the Pacific. And they had to be able to leave on a month's notice. And most people who were in school, or most people who were, or the astrobiologists who worked at NASA, were like, that's really tough. I got this strict schedule, and I got research, and I got grants. And I was like, I'm free. I'm good. I'm all good. You know, I can go with you. And so I got to go on this awesome cruise. And on the cruise, there was actually, when I said it's coming out moment, because I was talking to one of my colleagues. He is a PhD astrobiologist, and he said, Loretta, in this movie, in this IMAX movie, you can't tell people that you're an astrobiologist because you're retiring. You said you don't want to be a scientist anymore. You have to be who you are. You have to be yourself in this movie. And it was a powerful reckoning, and like nerve-wracking, and I was scared, and I didn't, and it was really, for me, it was, you know, the road less traveled, because going to get your PhD, like, there's a real set track, and you go get your postdoc, and you go to become a professor. It's very known. It's you can just talk to people who've done it, and you know how to do it. But what I was trying to do now is set off and do something, be me. And there was no path to follow, and I was terrified. But the first step was in the movie, getting on screen, and when I come in and introduce myself in the movie, I say, I'm Loretta Hidalgo, and I'm a space explorer. Because that's who I am. Like, I am who I'm, that's who I was. I mean, there wasn't a major for that. If I could have majored in space exploration at Stanford, I would have done it in a heartbeat, but they didn't have that. So my whole career has been like trying to be more who I am out in the world, be more comfortable with that. So now, so that was 2003. There's been a lot of adventure between there. But, you know, going to the Canadian Arctic and going to NASA headquarters, getting fired from NASA headquarters, that was also a really great adventure. I was like crying in my, you know, I was just like devastated. This is my dream job. I was doing great stuff. I was getting the world excited about Mars and I got fired. And it was like this big failure. And you're like, what do you do with failure? Especially when you have an ego as big as mine, you know, failure is terrible. And I had a NASA, a one-star general, Pete Warden, who's the center director for NASA Ames, he called me up and he said, Loretta, I've been fired 6 times. He's like, if you don't get fired, you're not pushing hard enough. And I was like, awesome, thanks, Pete. That made me feel better. But what was cool about it is, in the end, like in hindsight, like when you're going through it, it's excruciating and it's scary. But in hindsight, it's like it was sort of like getting kicked out of the nest. You know, you get out of that comfortableness, and because comfort isn't where happiness is. Happiness isn't like a comfortable house and a comfortable life. Happiness is being fully used up for what you came to Earth to do. And so, it wasn't until I got kicked out of that that I really had to rethink who I am and what I'm here to do. And I started going around to colleges, and I started leading, launching your career at space workshops for undergraduates and getting them fired up about making the difference they came here to make and what we could do as a space industry. And I started to like get honest with myself about what I'm here on Earth to do. And what I'm here on Earth to do is alter the trajectory of humanity. Like, I'm not here to like study bacteria in the sub-basement. I'm here to help us create the science fiction culture that you read about, like the Star Wars and Star Trek. I want us to have that culture of the science fiction future, not just the spaceships. So in my industry, we build the technology, we build the spaceships. But I want us to have the culture that goes along with it. I want us to be extraordinary. That's why I call myself a Jedi. Because I'm training people to be Jedi. I'm training people how to interact with each other, how to be honest with each other, how to love each other, how to communicate, how to be themselves, how to be confident, how to pursue, how to make the difference in the world they came here to make. Because if all of us were doing that, that would be a pretty kick-ass planet to live on. Yeah. And because if we build all these spaceships, if you guys build me a warp drive, you get me to Saturn in 6 days, which, by the way, I hope you do that. That would be really cool. You know, we do all these, we build a replicator, we build a tricorder, we build, you know, a hyperloop, you know, we build anything you want, but we're still being jerks to each other, and we're still being jerks to ourselves. Like, what do we really have? It's like same, you know, different planet, same crap. So, what I'm here today to tell you, what I want to encourage you guys to do is to figure out what you came to Earth to do. What's the difference you want to make for your world, for your planet, for your species? And give yourself permission to do that. Because the more all of us give ourselves permission to blaze our own trail, and take the road less traveled, the more you'll be able to give permission for other people to follow their dreams too. Thank you.
Well, if you ever end up on a panel in your lives, don't follow a Jedi. So I did polar expeditions, and if someone had come up to me when I was 16 years old, and I was 5 feet tall, weighed about 120 pounds, and told me that I'd be doing polar expeditions by the time I was 27, I would be like, that sounds pretty cool. But how the heck is that going to happen? And looking back, it's not like one simple decision that led me to that point. I mean, it's some of the exact same themes that these other people are talking about. It's about failure, it's about trying new things. is about being true to who you are and kind of your childhood dreams and what excites a person as a child. When I was a child, I wanted to be Indiana Jones. And I actually went in the garage one day and got out a shovel, and we went to the kitchen and got a sieve or a colander, and went out to the backyard and started digging. And kept digging, trying to be Indiana Jones. I think my mom laughs at it now, but she didn't really appreciate when I came inside all muddy. I wanted to be Indiana Jones so badly that I actually went on to study archaeology in college. And I was kind of a history dork. I watched the Discovery Channel. I liked old things. I liked stories of King Arthur and kind of fantasy land a bit. But I liked all those stories. I wanted to dig them up. So that's what I went and did as an archaeologist student in college. And I loved it. I got to go to Denmark. I got to go to New Mexico and work in the fields, dig pits, walk around thinking about what life is like in the past. The artifacts are not as cool as what Indiana Jones was looking for. But it was still, I really enjoyed the field work. But I tried to make it a career. I even like wrote my college paper. My final college paper was a big archaeological paper. I didn't love it. It was very hard to admit to myself, hey, I've spent 4 years of my life trying to be an archaeologist. And I spend most of my time with archaeological grad students, archaeological professors. But it doesn't spark me like it did when I was a child. When I was in college, for some reason, I went to Urban University, Northwestern University, just north of Chicago. And I also got into backpacking. Who's ever been backpacking? All right. And pretty high numbers, I would think, around here. But not everybody. Anyway, and I got into a new student program that was a backpacking trip. Kind of founded on Outward Bound. Who knows what Outward Bound is? Outward Bound is a wilderness education and leadership school for people ages 13 on up. The way it works is a random group of people, or sometimes an established group, or most of the time a random group of people sign up and do a wilderness expedition. But this is not a guided expedition. On an Outward Bound course, the instructors teach the students how to run their own expedition. It's all about experiential learning and taking ownership over that own trip, and learning to communicate with the team, to solve problems, to take on big challenges like climbing mountains, or canoeing 25 miles in a day, or carrying an 85-pound canoe on your shoulders a mile without putting it down. So Outward Bound is all about confidence, self-esteem, and doing things really, really well. It's an experiential school. And it tests people. It's outcome courses are difficult. But they also take place in the wilderness to give people a chance to reflect on their own lives and changes they want to make. And it gives people a chance to reflect on the relationships they have as well with their family and friends. Anyway, I joined this trip in school that was founded on Outward Bound. It was a backpacking trip for new students, like an orientation style trip. And I totally fell in love with it. And the next year I ended up leading an entire program with another student. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. It was like my real major in college. Even though I loved archaeology, and I was kind of fashioning myself a slightly academic person, I could not stop thinking about the power of small teams and just individuals in the wilderness taking on challenges and what positive has come out of that for people. I thought about it all night long. Like it was just like a sign to me that, hey, something is right here that is very, very exciting and feels like that excitement that I had when I was a child. Like when I was digging up the backyard trying to be Indiana Jones. Like something was right, but here I'm going to this university, and what am I going to do, go live in a tent? And I was pretty decent at math. I did well in an economics course, and the professor called me and asked me, I said, hey, John, I think you could be a good economist. You should come talk to me about doing economics. And I just felt like I felt slightly sick in my stomach, even though I thought I might make some money as an economist. And that's not to say, if you're into math and you want to be an economist, go in and whole hog. But it wasn't for me, and that was another sign. So after college, I actually went to work for a company called The Road Less Traveled. which was like Outward Bound Light. Outward Bound is expeditionary. They drop people off at a trailhead or a put-in if you're canoeing or whatever activity you're doing, and then they go out for several weeks, often without resupplies. They are self-sufficient. And The Road Less Traveled was more or less a van trip for teenagers. It was a lot of fun, and I encourage people to do trips like this because they get to visit all the cool places in the country. And we would drive around and go whitewater rafting, then we'd drive around another couple days and go rock climbing, then we'd drive around another couple days and go backpacking. I had a great time, but to me, it wasn't challenging enough in the way I wanted. I wanted it to be out and around. And I also was kind of searching around to find my niche. I felt I wanted to be a rock climber as a mountaineer. And so I tried, and I signed up for some rock climbing classes and tried to meet people who are into rock climbing, and really, yeah, I thought I liked it. And I kept trying and trying, but I wasn't that good of a rock climber. I'm more like a runner and a journey type person, I've realized, but it took a little while for me to figure that out. So I was running out of money, and I kind of was down in the dumps, and like, well, maybe I should go back to school and get a real job in an office or something. So I got lucky and got a job at Outward Bound the next summer. And that was a good summer. I felt like I was in the right place. I really liked the people I was working with. I felt like they were somewhat like mentors to me, that I could connect with them and ask them questions about how to be a better instructor, that they were caring about my own development. It felt like I was in the right place. I was challenged in healthy ways, and I was really happy with the Outward Bound curriculum and how it challenged students to think about their own lives and to build self-esteem and believe in themselves. But I still didn't have my fit. I was canoeing, and it wasn't really rock climbing, and maybe I should be a backpacker. Like, I wanted to specialize in something. And luckily, I got hired that winter to be part of the winter program. I've never been across country skis, maybe a couple times. I did a downhill skis a few times. I've never been dog sledding. I just got hired as an intern for a dog sledding cross country ski expedition program in northern Minnesota. Now, northern Minnesota in the wintertime is pretty cold. Minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit is normal. And colder is normal. I see some frowns. Colorado does a pretty good job of celebrating winter, so don't be afraid of winter. Get outside and let your body adapt. But that's another thing. Anyway, so I signed up for this winter expedition job as I was an intern. And as soon as I got behind a dog sled, has anybody ever been dog sledding? Not too many people. Who has a dog?
Who has a dog?
All right, okay.
There we go. Dog.
People like dogs. Well, a sled dog is a dog, but it's not a house dog. Sled dogs have houses, but they're outside. They're like a classic dog house. And most sled dogs have never been inside their entire lives. And these are physical animals. And these animals have a crazy, wild spirit. I think sled dogs, and all dogs descend from wolves, but sled dogs seem to have one or two paws still in the wild. They are physical athletes. Quick fact, sled dogs are the fastest animal on Earth at a distance over 10 miles. And a Iditarod sled dog can run 14 to 16 hours a day.
Wow.
At 12 to 18 miles an hour for 10 to 12 days straight. I mean, that takes a lot of food to keep the dog going, but that's an amazing pace. Anyway, I was on a dog pick on if we had cats. So I got hired. Here I am, we go down to the dog yard. The dog yard is where the dogs live, 60 dogs. 60 dogs make a lot of noise, especially when they know the people are coming around, because that means they're going to be able to run. Sled dogs live to run and pull. When you walk a sled dog walks you. It pulls your arm out of the socket, basically. We have to pull the dog up by its collar, pull its front feet off the ground, and two-wheel it on its back feet, otherwise we don't have control of the dog. That's how strong dogs are. So here we are, hooking up dogs, we put them in this harness that fits around the body, and they are just banging and banging on the chains that they are tied to because they want to run. We hook them up to the gangway, which is the line that comes out the front of the sled, and they're going wild. Like, very wild, like crazy, barking, this pandemonium. I'm just standing there shocked. Like, what did I sign up for? This is madness. But I also learned something about it that just captured me. Like, these dogs were pure. They were in the moment 100,000%. And I got to be a part of that. And we hook them up, and we release the rope that's tied to the sled. We're standing on the sled, and we shoot off down the trail. And it's 20 degrees below zero. My nostrils feel like they're freezing, and I'm happier than I've ever been in my life, I feel like. And that moment was a special moment for me. It's like, as soon as I got behind that dog sled, I'm like, this is what I want to do. And I went in 100%. I read about sled dogs. I talked to the other people at our bounce school over and over and over about dogs. I probably drove them crazy. And I couldn't not get enough of it. Here's how much I could not get enough of it. Our sled dog yard was about a quarter mile away from where we hung out, our office was, where we ate meals at this base camp. And it's cold out, minus 20, minus 25, and it was often my job as an intern to go scoop the poo, which is frozen. So 60 poops at least every day to go scoop. And I feed the dogs as well, and I socialize and pet them and get to know them. As an intern, I didn't have all the good gear, so I was wearing these boots that weighed about 3 pounds per boot. But I was so excited to go out there and scoop poop and be with the dogs. I would run at a dead sprint from the office building to the dog yard every single day. I don't know why I did that, but something inside me made me do that. And I was running to go scoop poop. And I think it's just like something in me, like that childhood spark was shining through, telling me, hey, John, you have to keep doing this. Even if it sounds crazy, this is where you ended up, living in the woods with a bunch of dogs. You have to keep doing this. And that's what I did. I went in 100,000% and focused on it keenly for several years. I ended up being the lead dog trainer in the dog yard, and doing many outward-bound winter expeditions, and got and started reading about polar exploration and dog sled expeditions around the world and to Antarctica, and early polar explorers like the astronauts of their time. They sailed their ships off the map of the world 100 years ago, parked their ships there for 4 years, completely out of touch, zero communication, no radios, nothing, no blogs, no plastics back then. Everything was wooden and leather. And they mapped and filled in and explored these unknown places on Earth. I thought that was just the coolest thing. Like, maybe I want to do polar expeditions, but how am I going to do that? And I was at one point, I was getting an hour-long course ready to go out on a trail. And I was kind of burned out about an hour-long this time. I was 5 years into my career. I was wondering what I should do next. And my boss came in and said, hey John, there's this expedition on Greenland that is a rerun of the original race in South Pole using all 1911 period food, clothing, and equipment, like going back into history. And these are books that I have devoured and used as leadership curriculum for outbound courses for years. And she said, you're off this course until you apply. You have to be done by 7 a.m. So I wrote my application. It was like a cathartic thing, and eventually I was drafted onto that team and got into doing polar exploration. And when I look back, connecting with people who are mentors, who know a lot about what I want to do or know some aspect of that, that was huge. I'm friends with some of my teachers from high school. I'm friends with the polar explorers around the world now because I knocked on their doors and wanted to learn how they did things and how they figured things out. And searching out mentors in your field or exploring that through other people can be a key to figure out where you want to land. Well, anyway, I feel like I've probably talked too long, but that's how I ended up as a polar explorer. Thank you.
You all now have the opportunity to ask our panelists a few questions. We would like to encourage students to go first before any of the public audience members join us. You can address your questions to any or all of the panelists, and you guys can jump in as you see fit. The microphone is right over here if you want to line up in the aisle. Go ahead, first question.
Introduce yourself.
Hi. It's on. All right. Hi. Hello.
My name is Jack, and I have a question for Chris. I was wondering if you advocate medical marijuana, specifically CBD, as an alternative medicine to treat CTE.
So do I want to be popular with the high school kids?
Peer pressure.
Yeah. Well, I think the science is evolving on it. I'm all for recreational marijuana. Responsibly. Seriously, responsibly. But there are a lot of former players that are looking into it. I'm meeting this week with Jake Plummer, who's the old Denver Broncos quarterback. Because there's evidence, Realm of Caring, the Colorado brand, Charlotte's Web, and there's others. And Jake's on the frontier of this. There's evidence that it can help. And I've had a friend pass away of an opioid overdose. And I think the side effects from medical marijuana and CBD can be better than prescription drugs. So I think proceeding responsibly and intelligently make a whole lot of sense. And Colorado is one of the first states to legalize marijuana, and destigmatizing it has been huge. I mean, I'm from Ohio originally, and when I go home, people act like it's taboo, but this is medicine. I mean, children with epilepsy, who it helps. People that with post-traumatic stress who can't sleep, that it helps. So the giggling is cool too, but scientifically, I'm excited about this because I hate to have people pass away because of over-the-counter drugs or prescription drugs when there's an alternative that can help them.
Thank you.
Strategies you have for figuring out what path to follow. You have many different interests. Mm. I'll take a shot. Yeah. I would say try them out. Mm. Try new things. I think exposing yourself to new activities or new perspectives is a great way to figure out what is going to light your fire the most. If you're interested in a lot of things, it's great to have a lot of passions. And sometimes that passion may develop into a hobby. And sometimes that's better than developing a passion for a career. If you're happy in your job and you feel like it's contributing positively to society, and you like who you work with, and it's stimulating and challenging, that's totally awesome. But that doesn't have to be your number one passion. You can have your number one passion as being a musician on the side, or skiing, or whatnot. I think that life is full of different opportunities, and as I've grown older, it's always been fun just to try new things. You know, when I'm 40 years old, you never know where that's going to end up. So I would say give them a shot and keep going.
Yes.
Okay. Hi, I'm Henry Simonoff, and I'm a freshman here at Boulder High. And Chris, I know you were like probably a great football player for both Wisconsin and San Francisco, like, but in your like Wisconsin football career, did you ever face the Colorado Buffaloes like in any way who leads to Wisconsin?
We never really played Colorado. I know a few guys from Colorado that are wonderful people. David Bakhtiari, I'm sure many of you know. And, so I like the guys that played here, and I love Boulder, but no, we never did play them.
I'll take that one. So
Stanford ego.
No. Yeah, no, I do. No, I own that totally. No, but my point is, I got to Stanford, and I love Stanford. Stanford's great, but I actually didn't take very good advantage of being at a prestigious school. Like, I had gone to a really awesome high school that was really close knit, and it was a private school, and it was a religious school, and like. It was a strong community, and I got thrown into a giant research university, and it was really hard for me, and it was really secular, it was really sterile, it was really academic, and I didn't feel the love, and I didn't feel the community, I didn't feel the support, I didn't have the teachers who were pulling for me like I did in high school, like that knew my name, and so, you know, that may not be the right path for everybody. It certainly is open, you know, had other benefits. But, you know, I had friends that went to, like, Rocky Mountain College, and, you know, they had other support that worked for them. And, you know, if you want to go be an investment banker or, you know, whatever, like, yeah, it's useful to have those, you know, go work for those paths that are more traveled, the prestigious street can help. But if you're going to create something totally off the grid, then, you know, it doesn't really matter where you go. It just matters that you find the right people to connect with the right people who are fulfilling your thing.
Let me add a little something to that, and I think that hard work can be its own end and mean, you know, that like the school may not matter that much in some cases, especially when you want to go where you want to go, but the work to get into it certainly will. Like jumping bars you set yourself is the most important part, and like it's always going to be hard work. The answer is hard work, yes. It's the best part of doing a weird job is the reward is more hard work. The reward is more hard work, you know?
The other thing I'll raise up while he's coming up is that the careers that you guys are going to have access to in your lifetimes don't exist now. Mm-hmm. And many of them you guys will yourselves invent.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't even predict what you guys are going to, what you're going to do when you grow up, you know, so sky's the limit.
My question is almost an addendum to what you just said, say you're a high school student, a little naive, and you've idolized this one career path for 15 years, your whole life, doesn't matter. What if, with all of your, every one of these evolving, changing career paths, how would you reconcile yourself with the fact that, and even the disappointment that maybe you're not meant for something you've idolized your entire life?
Wow. You know, I grew up dressing up like a football player and wanting to play in the NFL since I could walk. And I realized that, and then it was over, and it would never come back, and then I turned 24.
You walk the talk.
Yeah, which can be daunting. But you're forced to be positive. You're alive, you're forced to be optimistic, and the world is a big and beautiful place, and there's so many people doing incredible things. I would echo what Loretta said earlier when she wanted to work at NASA. Call. I mean, it didn't occur to me until I had a platform and I could get calls, but most people who had success want young people to have success. They want to help you. If you take an interest, then they'll take an interest. So in reconciling maybe something you love, I won't BS you, it's hard. Know that you're not what you do. Mm-hmm. and know that there's a million things you can do. And again, to steal from the Stanford graduate, imposter syndrome. Everybody has it. There's no such thing as the big time. The Pope's a guy in a hat.
Yeah.
You know, anyone can do anything. You just do it. And keep doing it. Don't be afraid to fail. Fail, and just keep going. Who cares?
Yeah.
Go for Sam said earlier, I think that where you end up in a specific career, if you have that in your mind's eye, like I wanted to be a football player too, but I was a little runt and it wasn't in my skill set. It was in my baseball card dreams, right? So I think life is going to be, it's going to show you that mirror sometimes. But let's say you're pursuing that dream that is unrealized. But the skills that you practice while pursuing that dream are translatable. So whether that's being creative, or being a good communicator, or being skilled at getting things done on time, so you can transfer that to all sorts of different careers. And so I would say, if you run up against the wall, go back to like who you are, what are your values, what makes you happy, what kind of people do you like to be around, and try new avenues, and know that you can do it. Know that you have some skills that just didn't work out there, but they will somewhere.
So we mentioned mentors in this space, and I want to highlight that in response to your question, because I'm a don't ask for help, figure it out yourself, reinvent the wheel kind of a person. Every time I got to figure it out for myself. And the few times in my life where I've had enough humility to reach out to someone who actually knows about the thing I want to do, it has been life-changing. Because maybe the exact thing you're after isn't right for you. Maybe there's a thing that's like 2% off that you don't know about, you know? And there are people who live in this space. There are these successful people that really want young people to get what they want. I assume we all echo that 100%. It's the only thing we could imagine. That's why we're here, right? Is to like help you guys figure some stuff out. So like, reach out to mentors, find people, and go beyond your comfort zone. You know, like you'll be shocked at who will respond if you send a well put together email or make a good phone call. You know.
We're running out of time. We don't have time for all this clapping. One thing that I want to also give you is, you know, we're telling you the stories from the other side, you know, so I've gotten to, you know, dive to the bottom of the ocean with James Cameron, and, you know, I've gotten to, you know, I hang out with astronauts all the time. No, I'm just hanging out with an Apollo astronaut at a party under a space shuttle on Saturday. I mean, that's just what I do. I have Buzz in my cell phone. I mean, that's just normal, But what I want to convey to you is that there's nothing at the top. So like I talk to young people, and like what they want is to be a reality TV show star or a professional football sports person, or I can't think. Oh, or a crime scene investigator. Yeah, that'll be the third one. It's just not what it's cracked up to be. You know, people think, or I want to be rich. Like I want to, you know, make a lot of money. And I just wanted to like dispel these myths that I don't know where you're getting them, that's like the end all be all of coolness, because it's not. Like I hang out with those people and they're usually pretty miserable or weird or whatever. And you know, you guys, how many days do you have to go till you have somebody famous who overdoses or who gets arrested or who does something crazy or stupid? You know, they're not our role models. They're not who you want to pattern your life after. They're not happy. They're isolated, they're alone, they're scared, they're lost, it's pretty, yeah, they have an Academy Award, yeah, they've got an Oscar, an Emmy, whatever, a platinum album, but they haven't necessarily figured out who they are, or they're not necessarily connected and loving and articulate with the people around them and living fulfilled lives. So, like, make that your goal. You know, I've walked the red carpet for my movie premiere. You know, I've been in Richard Branson's private jet. You know, it's not. So I but the summer camp that I went to when I was a kid, where I learned to backpack, and where I learned to talk and share my heart and connect with people and have real friends who love me no matter what. Like, that means more to me than anything. When I still go back to my summer camp every summer and for the kids there. And I tell them, like, I'd rather be with you guys than on Necker Island because, like, this is real. And so if you guys can live lives where you're being real and where you're contributing your gifts and your unique talents to the world, and you're the only one who can do it. Like, if you don't give your unique talents and skills to the world, like, it won't get done because you're the only one who can do it. So yeah, just keep getting hands-on, keep throwing yourself out there, keep trying new things, throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
Thank you.